This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The Upjohn Institute for Employment Research launched a project last year to research how communities can attract and keep good jobs. Senior researcher Michelle Miller Adams and Upjohn Institute senior economist Tim Bartik are two of the co-authors of a report called Building Shared Prosperity: How Communities Can Create Good Jobs for All. A version of this interview was first heard in March. Welcome to both of you.
Thank you.
Good morning.
So what's the genesis of doing this report? Why did the Upjohn Institute want to take it on?
Well, we've long been interested in some of these topics. We've done a lot of work over the years on place-based scholarships, on job training, on economic development. And we decided to pull that together into looking at how we help places in general build good jobs for all residents, because I think it's an increasingly large problem in the U.S. We have a lot of places left behind. We may have Silicon Valley booming, but there are many rural areas, many small and medium-sized communities around the country where, despite the economic recovery, when you look at the prime age employment rate or you look at wage rates, people don't feel the economic recovery has reached them. And the question is, what can be done about that? And what we try in this report to do is focus on very specific policies for which we have some reasonable evidence they can work. And we're looking for policies that local communities can actually do on their own, because waiting for the federal government to solve these problems, we're likely to be waiting a long time.
Let me add, just on a much more prosaic level, this report also represents an effort to take some of the academic research that we do at the Institute and project it in a much more accessible way to a very broad readership. This is radio, so you can't see the report, but it's glossy and pretty, has photos, is written in plain English. There are no statistics and charts in it. So it's really designed for local government officials, for journalists, for city leaders to read and take away some of those specific ideas that can be implemented at the grassroots by local communities.
When we say shared prosperity, are we talking here about trying to get jobs to people who maybe haven't been able to find them, or if they've been able to find work, have not been able to find work that pays very well?
That's exactly right. I mean, we're talking about a very specific focus. In other words, sometimes when people discuss issues of prosperity, they just talk about, we need growth. Well, growth, if you have lots of job growth in the community, but it's just matched by population growth, it doesn't raise the employment to population ratio, what does it actually do for local residents? It's just growth. I mean, growth is only good if it actually delivers something in terms of a higher standard of living for specific people in the local community. If all it does is growth in and of itself, it doesn't really do much.
And if jobs are brought in which are very highly specialized, it may be the case that the people in the community, the overwhelming majority of them, don't have those skills. So at that point, you're just bringing in people to fill the jobs there and not doing much for the people who already live there, right?
Right. And that's why you can't work on just one side of the labor market. You need to not only bring better jobs in and figure out policy to do that, but you also need to work on developing people's skills. Not just through job training through programs, but through things like place-based scholarship programs such as the Kalamazoo Promise.
And there's absolutely nothing wrong with bringing skilled people to a community and creating jobs that require those people to move there to fill them. But that's just one part of the equation. And the other part is really thinking about how to create better opportunities for the people who've been left behind in a local community. There are not that many cities where growth is so high that they really can't accommodate more people and more jobs.
People who listen to this station regularly have heard both of you interviewed here regarding these topics: place-based scholarships, business incentives, tax credits, those sort of things. Is part of what you're doing here kind of linking these different subjects together in kind of one complete package that puts them in maybe one strategy?
Right. We're trying to link those together because, in fact, and there's a good reason to link them together, because the strategies are more effective as they go together. So if you're creating good jobs, if you also at the same time are creating the skills, it's more likely to rebound to the benefit of the local community. And for that matter, if you're talking about skills development programs, if they don't have strong ties to the types of job needs of employers, they're not going to be as effective. An effective job training program, in fact, has to take account of what skills employers actually want.
And we're trying to get away from the siloing that sometimes happens where people work on specific issues, they work on labor demand, they work on labor supply, and really think together about how these programs can inform each other to be more effective. We also, in this report and in this initiative at the Institute, are trying to more tightly connect our operations side, which actually delivers workforce training services in low-income communities, in local communities, and really think more clearly about how their practice can inform our research and how our research can inform practice.
Let's go to place-based scholarships here for a moment, because I think people might hear a lot of what we're talking about and think, well, when I hear about I think about the Kalamazoo Promise, I think of it as a way to keep families in schools. I think of it as a way to encourage students who otherwise might not be thinking of going to college that this can be paid for. And so that barrier is out of the way. What does it mean for a community's workforce development, or at least what's the potential?
Right. So we are really at the beginning of trying to study that question quite rigorously and look at students who received the Kalamazoo Promise compared to comparable students who didn't and see what happens to them once they are a few years into the workforce. We want to know things like what their income is, what their debt is. We also want to know where they live. Did they stay or come back to the local community? Did they stay in the state? Unfortunately, that is a research project that's dependent on data that we are waiting to receive from the state of Michigan, where our data systems are not linked to each other. So it's a pretty elaborate process to get that data. We have some anecdotal information from the Kalamazoo Promise, at least, that students who receive the scholarship, actually, it's more than anecdotal, it's some survey research that was done, are considerably more likely to stay in or return to the Kalamazoo area. But more generally, when you think about the workforce income, workforce impact of Promise programs, there are a couple of avenues through which these place-based scholarships can create a more educated workforce. The first is that they can obviously train people from the local community to get in-demand certificates or degrees and have them enter the local workforce. But these Promise programs also attract people from other places because of the value of the scholarship and also what it says about the community. And those are people who then become part of the local workforce. So it's a build your own and bring people in kind of two-pronged strategy that contributes to workforce impacts.
Michelle, you have often said that you think that a Promise-like program developed by another community should be open to all students. There should not be, for instance, grade point average requirements on them. But when you get beyond that, are there certain ways to structure the program that may make more sense for one community over another in terms of where you're willing to pay for students to go to college and things like that?
Right. Well, a lot of the Promise programs that are in this growing population of programs, and we're actually about to release an updated version of our database that has about 150 programs in it. Many of them just send Promise recipients to their local two-year institution, their local community college. And while that might be a less powerful tool for attracting people to the community, it's actually a pretty good tool for building a local workforce. Students who attend a local community college, and some of these programs are open to adults as well, who are already very rooted in the community, are more likely to stay in the local community and work there.
Tim, is that one of the tools that when we talk about trying to get workers ready and have a ready workforce for businesses, paying for people to go to community college can be one of those avenues?
Well, community colleges are a tremendous resource for the U.S., and I think there's a lot of evidence that community college training programs can be tremendously effective in helping build skills that employers need, as well as being a cheaper way of at least doing the first 2 years of college before you go to a four-year school. So community college are a tremendous resource that we need to strengthen. Now, Promise programs also, of course, build a local workforce by attracting parents. And there's a fair amount of evidence that Promise-style programs have had a positive effect on particularly reducing out-migration of people with kids from the community. They help. They make communities stickier as a place where people want to stay because, you know, they're willing to stay there and invest in the schools and be involved in the schools because there is this return. They know their kids have their college paid for.
Can it also be something that may get the eye of somebody who's in looking for a place to locate their business?
Well, yeah, I think ultimately we have to look at what are businesses looking for when they try to locate or expand? Well, there are many things. I mean, everything matters to some degree. Taxes matter to some degree. But labor supply is absolutely key. If you don't have labor supply of the kind of workers you need, you're not going to locate in a community. So a community that is attractive to people through a variety of things, amenities and things like promise-style programs, is going to definitely not only attract more people, but attract more business.
There's a section in the report on something called the KC Scholars Program. What does that do?
KC Scholars is a very large-scale place-based scholarship program in Kansas City that was created by the Kauffman Foundation. And we have been working with them for several years around both design of the program, but also evaluating it. And it is very different from the Kalamazoo Promise, in part because it spans a really large region. So it's a 6 school districts in 6 counties across 2 states. But it also has a very strict, it is not a universal program where everybody gets it. It's a very generous scholarship program, but there are quite a lot of criteria. There's a whole elaborate scoring system around need and merit and community service and family type. So it's quite different. But what we have seen in the KC Scholars Program, which is what we featured in this report, is that the program has acted as a catalyst for new kinds of relationships among existing players in the community, in this case, among the higher ed institutions in the Kansas City region, as well as the school districts. So you've seen this very tight network emerge where higher ed institutions are not really acting as much as they did in isolation from each other, but are collaborating in new ways. And so, for example, a specific example is that there's been a lot of work on transfer protocols and the move from 2-year degrees into 4-year institutions and trying to really organize a cohesive, clear, open transfer process for higher ed institutions. And it was really the KC Scholars that brought that alignment into being. So we use it in this report as an example of how promise programs can serve as catalysts for institutions to do things in new ways.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. The Upjohn Institute for Employment Research released a report earlier this year called Building Shared Prosperity: How Communities Can Create Good Jobs for All. This interview with two of the report's co-authors, Upjohn Institute senior researcher Michelle Miller Adams and senior economist Tim Bardick, was originally published in March. So we have businesses that, of course, need workers. Let's assume for the moment here that we can get those workers trained in such a way that they can fill those jobs. Is there then another step that has to happen to make sure that those businesses know that those workers are available and those workers know that there's jobs waiting for them?
Right. Well, we need, obviously, everyone talks about training programs and job matching programs. One of the things we outline in this report is that you really need to think of training programs more broadly as what I would call active labor market programs. That is, if you really want to link the people who need jobs with the employers who need workers, you need to have your training program be embedded in the neighborhoods that need jobs, in the organizations that have credibility in those neighborhoods. And you also need your program embedded in employers and try to build those links. We highlighted in the report some programs that the operations division of the Upjohn Institute is running. One is called Neighborhood Employment Hubs, which the Kellogg Foundation helps fund and operates in Battle Creek, and basically involves taking job training and saying, we're not just going to put it in some place that's outside the neighborhoods that need the job. We're going to put it in neighborhood institutions in this case in Battle Creek, but it would apply more generally. Let's put the job training site where the people who need the jobs are.
And where they already have relationships already, with those institutions.
Right.
So it's not, hey, come to this office and apply for a job, but it's people that you work with and see and interact with and trust who work in your own community. And it's really a new kind of approach to job training.
And then, of course, you put staff there who know about what job openings are at different area employers and know what are the good jobs and what are the good jobs and what are the different skill requirements. Now, on the other side, there's a program called Employer Resource Networks, where basically small and medium-sized employers help pay a fee to have a success coach who works with job seekers when they get a job. One of the issues with job training programs that's a problem in many job training programs is you train someone, they get the job, but then frequently, you know, there are various barriers to work that have made it hard for them to find a job. That's why they're in the training program in the first place. There are various family problems. There are transportation issues. You can child care issues. You go on and on and on. And a lot of times that leads to the person losing a job. Well, that's not in the interest either of the job seeker or the employer. That's a problem. That job turnover is extremely costly for employers.
You have to train somebody new.
You have to train someone new. You got to advertise the vacancy. You got to. You know, there's a whole host of things. You lose production in the interim, so you don't. You want higher job retention. So the success coach, the idea is that they work with the employer and with the job seeker to try to overcome some of these problems. I mean, let's work out the transportation problem. Let's see if we can get the car fixed. Let's see if we can figure out a way of the person to get to work. Let's figure out, okay, child care. There are various resources out there that help you find childcare that will work for you. So I think that you need to go beyond simply thinking of a training program as a one-time thing that you run in some separate place and need to think of it as something that is designed to link people where they live with jobs and keep on doing that even after that you've made the placement.
Very large employers will have their own staff to do those things. They'll have employee assistance programs, childcare facilities, but these employer resource networks really make that possible for small and medium-sized businesses because they essentially cost share and collaborate around those expenses.
Tim, you've done a lot of research on business incentives. One of the things that this report says, and which you have said previously, is they should be targeted. Who should they be targeted for?
Well, I think business tax incentives should be as much as possible up front because those are more effective. You know, handing out a tax break 10 years from now when the person in the corporation making the location decision probably won't be working there by then anyway is not very effective. And it's too tempting for governors and mayors to give away their successors' tax base. So, and they should be targeted more at business with high multipliers that are particularly high-tech businesses that have a lot of local supplier networks. But beyond that, I think we should be relying more not so much on tax incentives, but on looking to the small and medium-sized business sector. And what the small and medium-sized business sector needs are not so much extra tax breaks, but various types of services. So, for example, manufacturing extension services work with small and medium-sized manufacturers to give them advice on how to find new markets. If they're trying to diversify, I mean, you have a company that either bends metal or molds plastic, and maybe currently its market is the auto industry, but maybe long term they'd be better off if they were able to bend metal or mold plastic for the medical instruments industry. Maybe that's a growing market that they would benefit them to get into, but they don't know how to do it. If they're a large business, they can figure out how to do that. Small and medium-sized business might have more trouble making that transition to a new market. And so manufacturing extension is a relatively cheap thing that can help give business advice and can help make businesses dramatically more competitive. I think we'd get a higher return to our economic development investments if we focused on these customized services to small and medium-sized businesses and less on simply giving away cash. Giving away cash is easy. There's infinite demand for it. No one's going to say, don't give me cash. And there are big newspaper headlines associated with giving an Amazon or a Foxconn or some other large corporation lots of money. But providing these services to small and medium-sized businesses is a more effective long-term strategy.
So one of the things we're told towards the end of this report is that a community needs to build strong civic leadership. That sounds great, but in terms of actually making it happen, what are the steps?
Yeah, if they're lucky, they already have strong civic leadership. And then there's also a question about the nature of that leadership as well, which, you know, we touch on very briefly in the report. But again, it looks different in every community. There is a lot of research and evidence. It's not super quantitative research, but that the communities that had forward-thinking, diverse groups of leaders connected with each other have been able to kind of look ahead and make good strategic decisions on the part of their community about how to reorient economic development. How you build that civic leadership is probably going to look different from place to place. But, you know, we look at a lot of the experience in this report is embedded in our local community. In Kalamazoo, we had a major shift in the leadership paradigm 20 or so years ago when this wasn't ever exactly a company town, but it was kind of a company town when it came to civic leadership. It was the Upjohn Company that helped invest in various community initiatives, found community organizations, make strategic decisions. And when the headquarters of the Upjohn Company went away, there was, I would say, a bit of a leadership vacuum for a while. And I think we're almost really still figuring it out, but it's clearly a broader set of leaders. There are a lot of issues around how you include and represent low-income residents and leaders of low-income communities in civic leadership. I think you know from previous conversations, Gordon, that in general, I'm a big fan of anonymity when it comes to the Kalamazoo Promise. I think the fact that our donors are anonymous has been a good thing for the community and for the promise. But I worry a little bit about a lot of things getting done through anonymous donations and plans, because I think it can lead to something of a democracy deficit. So we have an initiative now in the community that I think is promising. The Shared Prosperity Kalamazoo Initiative, which was really catalyzed by the Foundation for Excellence donation. And the potential of that initiative is to really bring kind of traditional corporate business institutional leaders to the table with a more broad-based set of leaders who really have to be included because it's their city too.
And Kalamazoo, as you say, was at one time thought of as mainly a pharmaceutical town, as you say, maybe not as exclusively as some other cities are linked to an industry, but there's been a change in identity. So is part of the recommendation for communities to think about what you might be next, that perhaps the big company in your town will not be there or will be have a significantly smaller presence in, say, 20 years?
Right. But I think you need to build on what your current strengths are. So in Kalamazoo's case, so I think the business research park, that many people invested in, the city, the university, Southwest Michigan First, many other groups try to develop the Business Research Park, and a lot of the businesses there are somehow related to pharmaceuticals, but not all of them. I mean, so they're not putting all their eggs in one basket, and there's a variety of higher tech businesses. There are ties to the engineering school. And I think on the whole, that's a wise policy. I mean, one of the things that also is cheap as a way of developing things is just providing land that is suitably zoned for industrial development and business development, making sure the utilities there, making sure the roads are there, and the other infrastructure there is actually can be a fairly effective strategy for economic development and can have a much higher return than simply handing out cash.
I want to add a word about KVCC, our local community college. Tim mentioned earlier that community colleges are these huge untapped assets in terms of educating people, but they also are really important economic development players. And if you look at the investments that KVCC has made over the past, I don't know, 5-6 years in downtown and the industries that they represent, it's interesting. The big investments are around health professions, training people for health professions, a lot of synergies with the hospitals, with the Western Medical School, but also the culinary arts and food systems innovation. Those are the big downtown bids of the community college, and that relates to an older history of Kalamazoo, which was a big agricultural player many years ago and is in a part of the country that's known for food production and is kind of in keeping with our history. So the idea is that when communities are struggling, they often think, you know, what do we have to do to land this giant plant that will employ a bunch of people and, you know, solve all of our economic woes. And that is a very low percentage strategy. And so really trying to think organically about the assets you have in the community, your role in the broader regional and state economy, and how you can develop new industries and build on existing industries in keeping with that identity is important. And it takes leadership to figure that out.
And there are also other assets that you might not think of. I mean, you know, one of my hidden assets of Kalamazoo is Kalamazoo College, which is a small college. It's I've described it some places as a quirky little college. I hope they don't mind that characterization. And since we happen to be recording this on Oberon Day, it's just interesting. You know, Larry Bell was attended Kalamazoo College. It's actually interesting the number of little small businesses around Kalamazoo that have some ties to Kalamazoo College graduates. There's this, I think they've contributed a lot of entrepreneurial energy to Kalamazoo. That's an asset the community has. And one of the things you have to figure out how to do is how do we, if you have people with interesting business ideas, how do you encourage them to develop them? And there are things you can do. I mean, some people say you can't do anything. Entrepreneurship is just something that happens or doesn't happen, nothing you can do about it. Well, it may be true that, you know, someone needs to have the desire to do something new to start a business, that you can't, in some sense, totally teach that. But you can teach people things like, you know, how to get financing, how to put together a business plan,
how to do a market analysis.
So yeah, you can also try to make relatively cheap space available. That's what a business incubator is. So
yeah. So when you say you can help that, I mean, is that local government helping that? Is that perhaps a coordination of, you know, business, higher education, some sort of an economic development agency, which may be privately funded?
It's a combination of things. Yeah, it's both. It's the local government, because ultimately there has to be, in order for these things to operate in a way, they need some public subsidy. On the other hand, you don't necessarily, a lot of times these things are like quasi-public, quasi-private, mm-hmm. and they reflect a partnership between different elements of the community. And that's what goes on here, I mean, with the small business development services we have.
Tim Bartik is senior economist and Michelle Miller-Adams, senior researcher at the Upjohn Institute for Employment Research. They are two of the authors of the report, Building Shared Prosperity, How Communities Can Create Good Jobs for All. Thank you for your time.
Thank you so much, Gordon.
Thank you, Gordon.
A link to the Upjohn Institute's report can be found at WMUK.org. A version of that interview was first heard in March. You can subscribe to WMUK's West Southwest podcast through Apple iTunes and by searching for podcasts in Google Music. It can also be found at WMUK.org and through the WMUK app. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.